Hello, and welcome to another episode of Boundless Body Radio. I'm your host, Casey Ruff, and today we have another amazing guest to introduce to you now. Dr. Molly Maloof's mission is to radically extend our human health span, the number of years free from disease or disability, and maximize human potential by promoting wellness lifestyles that generate optimal health. She is the author of the book, The Spark Factor, Supercharge Your Batteries for Limitless Energy and a Fitter, Stronger, More Resilient Future. As a physician and lecturer, Dr. Molly has spent her career providing personalized medicine services to high-performing technology executives, billionaire investors, Silicon Valley entrepreneurs, and Academy Award-winning actors. She is a former lecturer within the Wellness Department of the Medical School at Stanford University. Since 2012, she has also worked as an advisor or consultant to more than 40 companies in the digital health, consumer health, and biotechnology industries. Dr. Molly challenges healthcare practitioners, as well as industry influencers, to rethink health and healthcare in order to reduce costs, improve patient outcomes, and optimize the human condition. Dr. Molly Maloof, what an absolute honor it is to welcome you to Balanced Body Radio.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Thanks for being on here. It's such an honor to host you. Somebody may have heard that introduction and might assume that you're still in California, but you've actually relocated to Texas. How's that going?
You know, I love it that like nobody really knows where I live, but I do live in Texas. But everyone's like, are even my friends who live here are like, do you really live here? And I'm like, I'm on airplanes a lot. But you know, Texas is great because it's such an awesome home base. And one of the things that I learned and I've been really perpetuating since the pandemic is this importance of human connection as a big, huge driver of longevity and happiness. And I have to say that the more connected I feel and the more people that I am surrounded by that I love and trust that make me feel safe in the world, the more I feel like I'm flourishing and the more that I feel just overall well-being and I feel more resourced. And so Austin really offers a particularly fun atmosphere filled with music and just great down-to-earth people. And it's a much more embodied city than San Francisco, but I do miss the hyper-intellectual, super ambitious, ruthless vibe of San Francisco. I do miss it, so I'll be going back to visit a lot. But there's really no perfect place to live in the world. Like, wherever you live is what you make of it. And I do enjoy Austin for a variety of reasons, but the whole country really feels like home to me.
That's amazing. It's cool that you get to get out and travel as much as you say you do. That's a really awesome thing. I'll be in Austin actually when this episode releases for KetoCon. I'm super looking forward to checking it out. I've heard just the best things about Austin.
Yeah, Austin's got certainly a massive biohacking community. And I'm part of a gym called Collective. It's like literally a social club meets a gym with all sorts of amazing amenities. And then Austin also has quite a lot of interesting new media coming out of it. So for the things that I like doing with my life, I think it's a really good spot to be.
Wow. That's amazing. Well, at the time of this recording, it's April 3rd in Salt Lake City. It is snowing sideways outside. We've gotten so much snow. I'm so sick of it. I'm so looking forward to seeing some blue sky. I feel like I've not seen the sun since the middle of October. It's crazy.
Oh my God. Yeah. Wow. But it's great skiing.
It's fantastic. So the benchmark for a good ski year is 500 inches. We're already above 800 inches. They're supposed to get like 3 feet overnight tonight. It's crazy. The picture are
bananas.
It's bananas. Yeah, it's a little excessive for sure.
Yeah, I get it.
Well, I really love your book, The Spark Factor, and I enjoy the way that you wrote it. It's very approachable. I think a lot of us have this idea that, like, you know, doctors have everything sorted out. They learn the best information. And I really get the impression through your introduction, especially in hearing your own personal story, that you also face a lot of challenges in that industry and had to learn things a little bit different way. So can you tell us about your experience through learning health and healthcare?
Yeah. Well, you know, as somebody who has always wanted to be a doctor, like since I was a child, and then I got the dream of becoming a physician, and it was through lots of hard work and many rounds of burnout and overextension that I finally got to medical school. And I found myself really unhappy. And I was like, oh my God, I got to change my lifestyle. And so I started changing all these things about the way I was living my life, which was really beneficial. And I had to do it because I wasn't in a good place. And I ended up just ridiculously improving my performance. And I was like, how is it that a change in my lifestyle has led to better grades and more well-being? And I never really understood it from like the fundamentals. I just knew that by changing my lifestyle, I got better grades and I got better performance on board exams. And I was like, And then from then on, I was like, man, there's something to this thing of health, but this thing of health is not part of our education. You know, it's like, it's actually this thing that's been separate from my education that I had to actually add to my the curriculum of my medical school. And I designed a course called Physician Heal Thyself, Evidence-Based Lifestyle. And it was the first wellness course at the University of Illinois. And it was really a product of me wanting to teach my peers how I improved my performance and health, and ended up being really successful. But then I got to my residency and I was just so out of place. I mean, at the end of the day, there are going to be people who do really well in bureaucracies and, you know, people who join the military, people who go into medicine, people who work at big corporations, they're best suited for work that is part of a larger system. But I have always been a bit of a rebel and questioning the status quo and thinking about how things could look differently in the world, and also been a bit of a futurist, somebody with a lot of foresight. And I did not fit in my residency. And I found myself constantly butting heads with my attendings. And I was kind of the black sheep of the program. And I was so miserable that I was thinking to myself, this system is going to make me sick. I'm going to get sicker and sicker and sicker until I'm diseased, just like everyone I'm seeing. And a lot of my attendings were visibly ill. Like one of them had lymphoma and was like going to work with massive lymph nodes sticking out of her arms. And I was just thinking to myself, this system is poisonous. And I hate to say it that way because I know a lot of doctors and nurses are listening, but you know, I knew myself and I'm an extraordinarily empathetic person, and I could feel so much of the pain of my patients. And there just wasn't a good amount of mental wellness training in medical school and residency. So you see all sorts of traumatic things in the world, and then you're expected to just go home and process it on your own and go back to work the next day. And it really wore on me to the point where I was really getting to the point of fully being burned out after only a year and a half of my internship. And then I had just a moment of just clarity. And I was just like, well, I don't really have to do this, but I don't want to. But that was really scary because then I was like, well, if I'm not going to be in the system, where am I going to go? What am I going to do? And fortunately, I was surrounded by some really talented people who were dropouts of their colleges and grad school programs and were building multi-million dollar technology companies that were a product of their ingenuity and innovation. And I was like, okay, I'm not stupid. I have a good enough head on my shoulders and I'm going to figure out how to make money. I'm going to leave my residency and I'm going to get my license and I'm going to start my own medical practice. And I'm going to start my own journey of figuring out how do I optimize health instead of just fix sickness. And I'm going to study health and I'm going to figure out what it's about. And I got a job after I'd gone to Burning Man, and I was in a particularly influential Burning Man camp that was filled with companies like Founders Fund and Facebook and Summit Series. And I was all these rationalists. And I was like, whoa, I am really fortunate, but I left Burning Man with a new job that had doubled my income and half my work hours. And I started on a journey into self-discovery, both concurrently working with startups as well as working on my own medical practice. And I got some great mentors that taught me how to optimize health instead of just fix sickness. And I was like, wow, this is a job. So cool. And, fast forward 10 years later, and I've worked with actually over 50 companies in personal health technologies, wearable tech, digital health, biotech, foods, and supplements. And so I've had kind of a dream decade of work in the last 10 years. Like I look back on, really, it was 2012 that I kind of jumped into my own journey, my own path. And now we're 2023. So it's been a solid decade. And I'm in a place in my life where I'm a published author. I got to teach at a top tier institution. I get to work with really cool companies and I get to work with big organizations and giant like institutions like life insurance companies and new startups. And I get to build, I still have my own medical practice and I have my own platform building products and services around the science of love and human connection. And I kind of feel like I have this dream life. Like it's so funny. I live next door to a billionaire and I'm not a billionaire and I'm renting my house, but it's like, I literally feel like I have the quality of life of somebody who's much wealthier And I have the, I have the quality of connection and community of like, it's just, it's so much more important to me than money, you know? And it's funny because like, I think success is really being able to live your life on your own terms and being satisfied with your existence and not really, you know, I'm not like grasping for more. I'm like excited about whatever's coming next, but it's not coming from a place of like, I have to do this in order to get here, in order to be this. It's more like, how can I fall in love with every moment of my life, every moment of my day, and like be doing work that makes me come alive? And this is a testament to pursuing health, because what health does is health is the ability to adapt and self-manage in the face of adversity. And it's really the product of your energy capacity. And when you tap into something that's much greater than you and this sort of field of infinite intelligence and beauty that's underneath everything, you not only have more capacity, but you feel more purpose. And that's my life in a nutshell. It came with lots and lots of work and effort and lots of pain and suffering. But you know, like it's something that I think is going to be eventually available to everybody. And I'm trying to create a world where people can flourish and not just survive.
Okay. Should we just end the episode there? Let's just end it.
Great monologue, right?
That's it.
I'm really good at these monologues.
We're done. That was the best monologue ever. That was fantastic and so well explained. I really, really love that. I recall hearing an episode of Joe Rogan. This is probably 2017 or 2018. It was before we started our business. And I wish I would have listened to this statement earlier in our career and starting our business. But I remember him having a discussion with somebody and saying, look, it's 2018 or whatever it is. There's no rules. There's no limitations. There are systems that you don't need to be a part of. You can get out of it. If you want to learn how to run a business, watch some YouTube on a weekend, start a business, start a website. You can do whatever you want. What a cool example that you are of that.
Yeah, it's true. But I have to say, like, if it wasn't for my community of people that supported me and gave me, like, saw me and were like, look, we believe in you. You believe in you. And I was like, I believe in me. And you got to start with self compassion, just believing in yourself. And what I do know is a reality for a lot of people is a lot of people have trauma that's unresolved. And that is like malware running in the back of their brain, inhibiting them from really fully realizing their potential. And I'm so excited about this next generation of products and services and technologies that are coming, because like there's literally going to be electroceutical frequency-based technologies that are going to literally shift your brain state into where you want it to be. And it's just right around the corner. I mean, like the solutions to healing for the masses at scale are coming, and they're going to be faster and cheaper and easier and like better than all the drugs that we've got.
Wow.
That are available to people. And I'm just like so optimistic and so excited about being a part of, like, part of what I'm here to do is like threefold, right? Like I'm here to be a leader in the space of health and medicine, showing that there's an example of a doctor who can do things differently. And then I'm here to promote and educate the masses through media. And then I'm also here to build products and services in concert with other companies and with my own company to create pathways for people to transform. And to me, like, this is like I'm living a dream that I didn't even know was possible. And it's just getting better and better every day. But I also am here to show people that like, we can change society collectively. Like we can come together and we can generate like a better world. And we have to stay optimistic. We have, because there's so much negativity and there's so much pessimism and there's so much fear. And it's just holding us back from being able to operate from a state of courage and reason and love. And that's where you can really manifest more than anything.
Yeah, that's amazing. I hope that pairs well with this generation that's coming up as well. I've noticed with a lot of my clients that are under 20, they're pretty smart. They're asking some like really
super smart.
They ask good questions. They realize that the way things are going, it's not working, and they recognize it. I have definitely noticed that.
I've seen some extraordinarily smart young people. And I also have talked to so many young people who have so much pain, and I see myself in them and who I used to be and what I used to feel like all the time. And I'm like, man, if only we can help them leapfrog over those burdens that I am such a fundamentally different person than I was in my 20s. And I'm just like, man, if young people can deal with their shit when they're 21 versus 31, then we're going to have hope for humanity. Yeah. But I'm really excited about the fact that there's so many young people that are really starting to recognize that, like, they want stable partnership, they want family, they want to have these core values. And there's almost a pendulum swinging back in the direction of, like, we all really know what matters, and it's family and community. You know, like, that's really the fundamental thing that matters in life. And if you don't realize that, you're missing out, because that's so much more important than money and power. I've hung out with some seriously wealthy and powerful people, and I'd say so many of them are really staring up from an abyss. Not all of them, but a lot of them. And I think there's this idea that, like, these like sort of American values of, like, achieving this outward oriented, like, you know, position is, like, somehow the path to happiness. And I had one of my mentors told me recently, he was just like, I really hope that you don't fall into the same trap that I have, because I've built an empire of dust. And, you know, I live in this extraordinarily gorgeous mansion, and there are days where I'm so unhappy, and I'm like, wow, you know, like, we think that that's what brings people joy, and it doesn't, it really doesn't. And so that's the thing I'm hoping to get across to people listening, is, like, focus on the things that really fundamentally matter, which is your relationships, you know, like, it's the next frontier of biohacking, is hacking our relationships and hacking our sexuality and hacking our connection and hacking our ways of getting along better with others. And it's not always easy, but it's really the work that needs to be done to bring people more joy and fulfillment.
I love that so much. I know that Dave Asprey wrote your foreword, and I think biohacking, when we hear that, we kind of have that connotation of, like, okay, I need to live like Dave Asprey, you know, maybe tons of supplements or, you know, all kinds of different things he's testing out. But you make a really good case for biohacking in your book, and why all of us should be thinking, how can we biohack our own lives? And it makes a lot of sense to me. Tell us the difference between the way you're proposing that we biohack our lives versus the connotation that some of us might have?
I think the traditional biohacking path has been a little bit about trial and error. And one of the things that I'm hoping to help people learn is that there is a path of biohacking scientifically. And it's really about taking the scientific method and applying it to your own N=1, you know, study of you. And I really like my friend Joe Cohen's website, Self Hacked, because there's more and more products and services available to people to actually do these N=1 studies. But it's really, one of the things that I've always kind of emphasized is, like, what you can measure, you can change. And even though I'm more and more interested in the psycho-spiritual realms of biohacking, because it's just the frontier and there's a lot of really cool stuff happening in that space, I still believe that we do need to look at empiricism as much as possible so that we're not just randomly doing experiments on ourselves. So in my practice, I gather a lot of data on my clients, and I gather a lot of laboratory tests, and I really start to come up with hypotheses of what I think is going on based on this information so that we can come up with a plan. So it's a mixture of the scientific method meets the SOAP note in medicine, which is a subjective, objective assessment and plan. And when you combine this hypothesis generation with data gathering, with assessment creation, and then with testing, you get this cycle of health optimization, which is about systematically looking at different places in your health that can be altered and changed. So most people are deficient in vitamin D, and magnesium, and omegas, and B vitamins, and hydration, and exercise, and sunlight, and human connection, and proper nutrition. And so those are all areas that you can really systematically say, okay, let's just, like, look at my lifestyle. What time am I going to bed? What time am I waking up? Put on an Oura ring. It'll tell you a lot about yourself. I need to charge mine, actually. So let me put that in over here. But I love the Oura ring. I love the blood sugar monitor. And it's not about being perfect, but it's about really looking honestly at what's going on in your life and your body, and trying to come up with a decision system for yourself of, like, well, how optimal do you really want to be? Do you want to be perfect, or do you want to be happy? Because, like, what I've learned is that when I was the most perfect at health optimization, when I lived in San Francisco, I wasn't happy. And so now I'm about, like, more like 90%, and I'm like, I think if you can really take the 80-20 rule into your life, you're going to live a really good life and you're going to enjoy it. Versus like, if you're trying to 100% be perfect all the time, you're just going to be kind of limited. And like, I like to party and I like to, I don't drink, but I do like to go out with my friends. And sometimes I stay up till 3 a.m. on a weekend at a birthday party. And I basically was with my friends and we were all just like cuddling and connecting and laughing. And I have to say that like, sometimes that's more important to me than getting perfect rest on a weekend. You know, like I find it's all about like figuring out what are you trying to optimize for? And to me, one of the things that's my general rules is like, I try to take every opportunity I can to connect with people because I'm genuinely genuinely more happy, but I'm also an extrovert. So I understand that not everybody is an extrovert. Not everyone needs as much human connection as I do, but it does seem to like, I seem to get a lot of problem solved when I go out with my friends and I get insights and I get advice. And it's almost like, it's funny that like answers will come to me faster. So I don't know. Like, I think that you can be a biohacker and be imperfect, but still be moving in the direction of better and better health.
Yeah. No, that's very well explained. I really appreciate that. In the first chapter of your book, you do a great job, I guess, section of your book, you do a really great job identifying the problem. Can you tell us what is the human energy crisis?
So if you look in the big picture of the world, we are having a crisis of this, you know, we're basically having like a environmental catastrophe, whether you believe it or not. And there's a big problem of people using too many gas powered vehicles and too much gas in general, right? It's not good for the atmosphere. Well, similarly, we've created a food system that's very much dependent on carbohydrates. And as a result, and I would say also vegetable oils. And so these refined carbohydrates and these refined vegetable oils that are industrially produced, that are being fed to cattle, which is making sick animals. It's this whole system of like feeding people the wrong fuel and feeding animals the wrong fuel and ending up with, unfortunately, dysregulated metabolism. And so your mitochondria are the seat of health or disease. And when the metabolism breaks, so does the body. So does the mind. You'll start getting brain fog. You'll start getting pain physically because voltage is healing, but lack of voltage is pain. And people are like, want to label all these different conditions with all these different names, but the vast majority of mental illness and metabolic illness is due to mitochondrial dysfunction. And if you haven't read the book Brain Energy by Christopher Palmer,
fantastic.
It's a freaking great book. That book, along with my book, The Spark Factor, is going to give you a very well-rounded view of how metabolic health is affecting mental health and physical health. And I think that the big root of all of this is a society that is taking advantage of people's primitive drives to consume and to basically, like, if you think about it, we have this like system in society that's like constantly telling people that you need to buy food that is going to poison your body and your mind, and that you should drive cars and not walk around or ride your bike, and that you should watch media and be scared shitless every day, like worried about the next big problem or existential threat. And then from there, you're being fed all these solutions, which is drugs, surgery, shitty food, more cars. And it's like this problem that's leading to mitochondrial dysfunction. So mitochondria they function best when they're fed the right fuel. And when your body's moving to send the signal to make more of them, and when you have a healthy amount of stress so that it doesn't break the system, because mitochondrial allostatic load is the cumulative amount of stress on the system before it breaks. And that's not even to mention the amount of toxicity in the environment and the air and the water and in the products and the chemicals in our homes. Oh, and on top of that, the amount of, you know, infectious disease that's still plaguing society, the amount of mold toxicity and the viruses and bacterial infections that people don't even realize that they have until they finally get a diagnosis. And I'm just like, whoa, how do we become so sick? You know? And it's, we're really disconnected from nature and we're disconnected from the things that we need, that we're genetically predisposed to need, which is movement, sunlight, connection, and healthy food.
No, that's fantastic. Can you comment a little bit about the scale of this type of problem? Like, are we talking a majority of people? Are we talking a minority of people? Like, what are we talking as far as scale?
I mean, if you look at the obesity epidemic, it's just getting greater and greater and greater. But there's also a massive epidemic of people who are over fat and normal weight. So this is not just about obesity anymore. Like, I think something like only 8% of the American population is metabolically healthy. That's massive. That is like the majority of the country is metabolically unwell. That is insane if you think about it, because now where everyone's like, well, why are we so sick? Well, it's like everyone's metabolism is deranged, you know, like that's bonkers. And it's not surprising that people are shooting up schools and like crowds, because people self-destruct when their brains malfunction. And almost all of these people who commit these atrocities are mentally unwell. You know, and a lot of them are on SSRIs, which is even scarier.
That's scary.
Because, like, you know, and one of the things that I read was like a lot of these people who are committing these horrible crimes are actually committing suicide almost always. And it's just before they're about to kill themselves, they kill a bunch of people. It's really a tragedy.
It is. Yeah, that's so sad. I love the way that you ask your readers to kind of assess their own energy, and you almost compare it to like a video game character that has a battery and kind of allows the reader to self-assess what their energy is like. And if most of us are deficient in that energy, we've talked about a few things, but what are some of the more major things that you would like people to do to consider or maybe to change so that they can start to improve their metabolic health? What's, in your opinion, like the biggest lever that you can pull of all the things you've already mentioned?
Well, first and foremost, you got to get your blood sugar stable. It's hard to do. It takes a lot of discipline. There's a really good Instagram account that my friend runs called Nest Wellness. And it's like, she literally shows the type of recipes that really work for blood sugar. And the more and more you can just like focus on getting your blood sugar stabilized, figuring out what that's going to look like for you. For me, it's a more ancestral diet. For a lot of other people, it's going to be potentially even a Mediterranean diet. Some people even thrive on a vegetarian or vegan diet. That's not my body, but you got to find the right diet that's going to work for your metabolism. And one of the things in my book presupposes is that there isn't a diet for all people. And so we need to stop demonizing each side of the metabolic or the nutritional spectrum, because there are people that are going to thrive on a vegetarian, vegan, and keto type diet, there's people who are going to thrive on a vegetarian and vegan diet. There's people who are going to thrive on more of a Mediterranean zone, sort of middle ground diet. And then there's people who are going to thrive more on a paleo ancestral keto diet. And then there's people who are going to be more balanced and kind of vacillate between both ends. But I don't really understand why there's so much animosity about food, because it's like, so what if somebody wants to eat a certain way? Like, all power to them. If that works for them, great. And I'm just kind of tired of the whole warring dietary tribes. I just think like you find what works for you and you stick with it, you know? And most of the time eating whole foods, real whole foods of like ingredients is going to be the path to the best response in your blood sugar.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I think that's a wonderful marker to check out as well. We talked about some of the things that maybe we can bring down, like eating less of the refined carbohydrates and seed oils. What does that mean for most people to eat more of?
I think that like, okay, so fruits and vegetables have been demonized by a lot of the paleo people, but there's so much evidence that fruits and vegetables are such an incredible source of phytonutrients and fiber and polyphenols and things that can feed the gut. And so I'm like, I do think that biohacking the diet that works for you, maybe looking at things like foods that activate histamine for people who are more atopic and have asthma and eczema, people who struggle with those conditions do need to be more careful with histamine inducing foods that can cause mast cell degranulation. People who struggle with kidney stones and maybe even joint pain might need to look at oxalates and be a little bit more careful with those. Some people do really well on a lectin avoidance diet. Some people who have autoimmunity should look at things like a Walls protocol. And like, you know, what I have found is that when I eat a diet largely of meat, vegetables, fruits, nuts, and seeds, and like seaweeds, you know, like I feel awesome. And to me, like that's what I figured out works for me. I don't do a lot of grain. Occasionally I'll eat some grain, like, but not often. Like I did a really wonderful naughty meal yesterday that was so delicious from this place called Picnic. It was like a gluten-free chicken and waffles. And I think like once in a while, you gotta have some fun. Like I rarely eat fried food, but they use avocado oil. They use gluten-free flours. They use pastured chicken. Like it was expensive. It was like, you know, it was an expensive meal, but you know, they use Vital Farms eggs. And like once a week, if you have yourself a splurge of something that really feels good, then great, do it. But most of the time what I eat is like high quality meats, vegetables, nuts, seeds, fruits. And it's a very paleo diet. That's what I found works. I've tried veganism, didn't work for me. It's just too high carb for my metabolism, you know? But you can't really avoid the argument around like the people that I think look the healthiest in my community are the people who eat proper amounts of protein and get exercise. Yeah. So I think there's a lot of arguments around protein consumption, but specifically when you're starting to age and you're like trying to maintain muscle mass, you can't really ignore protein. Yeah. And I see a lot of deficient protein consumption in the world. And it's kind of problematic.
It's a huge problem. I mean, we're proponents of the carnivore diet around here that seems to work well for us. We don't yell it from the streets. We have people come to us if they want to help and have questions or whatever. But across the board, I think that advice is just so helpful. Like get a little bit more, like try animal protein if you can. It's going to be way harder if you're vegan, vegetarian, but at least try to focus on the protein, and adding more of that protein in will automatically kind of make all the other crap just kind of fall down to a lower level. And you're right. Like if you do a splurge once a week, that's not the bulk of your diet. That's not what you're doing every single day. It's not going to be that big of a problem.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. I really do think that weightlifting is so fundamental to a great body and great health. So I'm one of my frontiers of my own personal health is like, I'm in good shape and I like the way I look. I'm a little bit more like curvaceous than I was when I was in my early 30s. But when I was in my early 30s, I was starving myself on stimulants, you know, like late 20s, early 30s, I was on Adderall and I was not eating enough. And so one of the things that I'm really excited about this next chapter is like, there's a bunch of coaches out there that like train you to up your calorie intake. And like, I think I'm probably at like 1500 calories a day, but I'm really looking forward to getting up to like 2500 a day.
Cool.
And so I'm working with a coach and we're like working on my diet and my exercise to like get my metabolism up even higher. And that's really exciting because I know a lot about health and I know that like my labs look fantastic and my brain feels good and my body feels healthy and I don't have any pain. But I know that like when I see the body type that I'm looking to accomplish in the next 10 years, it's like, I'm going to be in like really good shape in like a year and a half. Like, I think it'll probably take me about a year to get to the shape I want to get into, but I'm like stoked about that frontier because most of my 30s were just really dedicated to working really, 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 really hard. And I was doing yoga and weightlifting and some running, but the next frontier is like not full on bodybuilding, but definitely like body composition, shifting, cool. You know, like I'm looking to get an even higher percentage of even lower body fat and even higher muscle tone.
Cool. That's great. I don't know if you've been in contact with Robert Sykes. It sounds like it's right up his wheelhouse. He does Keto Savage and he helps people with reverse dieting all the time. So that might be a good fit. And we'll see him in person in a few weeks. So might be a good person to follow up with. You also talk in your book about fasting. And this is a very nuanced discussion of when people should use fasting as a tool and when they might be using it too much. Can you comment on both the pros and the cons of fasting, because I see tons of utility, but also a shadow side that can be pushed a little too far.
Well, we have so many people in this country who have eating disorders, right? Like Gwyneth, no, I'm not going to say Gwyneth has an eating disorder, but she got so much flack for her intermittent fasting. And everyone's like, she's got an eating disorder. It's like, no, she's like, and she's probably hitting 50. She's probably hitting menopause. And when you start losing estrogen, even if you're replacing it with like topicals, you're still going to be less insulin sensitive. And so I guarantee that she's got some good doctors looking at her blood sugar and saying, you know what, this might be helpful for you right now. Now, somebody who's 25 and sees her and says, well, Gwyneth is fasting till 12. Maybe I should. Turns out that young women need to be far more careful about fasting because of their fertility years and because of their, you know, menstrual cycles. And I've had more than one friend over-exercise and under-eat into relative energy deficiency of sport. And this is super common in women who are pretty lean and pretty heavily exercised, or they're just not eating enough calories. And then it causes hormone dysfunction. And then they're wondering what the heck's going on. Why am I stopping my period? So when I first got into fasting, it was in response to my fasting glucose being a little too high for my taste. And I was using first principles and I was like, okay, fasting glucose is dependent on the liver's function. So the liver's insulin sensitivity is basically measured by your fasting glucose. And so if I look at my fasting glucose and it's too high, then that must mean that there's some liver insulin resistance. So what is one of the best ways of like stripping fat from the liver and getting it to function better is you take the load off of your digestion and you give your liver some time to induce autophagy. And for me, it was a major shift in my health. But fun fact, it also accidentally led to a spiritual awakening. So a lot of people don't know this about fasting, but it's been a part of almost every religion in history. So I would be very careful for people who are also spiritual and doing a fair amount of fasting, because you can literally induce a pretty intense life change from fasting alone. And it was after a 3-day fast with a friend in Sonoma, where I was doing all of the biohacks you can imagine to optimize energy capacity. I was in Sonoma. I was in the sun. I'm getting all this structured water in my skin. I'm optimizing my circadian rhythms. I'm getting rest and relaxation. I'm meditating. I'm breaking a 2-day fast with a really amazing farm to table meal. And I'm kind of turned on because I thought I was on a date, but he wasn't really like interested and he was working with his own issues with his mood. And long story short, I go back to my place in San Francisco and I have a connection with my community. So I'm all plugged in and I'm just glowing fluorescently with health and life and vitality. And that night I just had like a full on like Kundalini awakening experience. And I'm thinking to myself, what is this about? Like, what is this thing? And I had asked the universe for a taste of enlightenment. I had gone through a lot of emotional challenges and a business readjustment and a breakup. And I was in a pretty rough spot. And just be really careful what you want to manifest, because it may come to you very quickly. And it set me on a completely different path. So the funny thing is, since being kind of activated in that way, I don't fast as much, because my body is just like, it knows what it wants and knows what it doesn't want. But I've also been under a lot more stress the last few years because of the pandemic. So I would say that like fasting is a really important tool in the toolbox, but it's also something that people need to recognize is really, really, really powerful stuff. And, it's not for everybody. And it's really best suited for people with metabolic dysfunction and people who have themselves. I think you should be pretty grounded in reality. Like, I'm not saying you shouldn't do it if you have mental illness or anything, but I think you should be a little bit more careful if you have things like bipolar or because I do think that like a lot of people don't fully realize that it does raise this like, it just increase energy in your body and there's a big cleansing process that can happen. And it can just be, it can be a really powerful mechanism for health and healing. I think people with PCOS and insulin resistance and prediabetes and diabetes are really the best suited for fasting, as well as people with obesity and metabolic inflexibility. But you have to look at your stress levels, because if your stress levels are off the charts, fasting is going to add stress to the stress cup. And so first thing you got to focus on is stress management before you even think about fasting. Fasting can improve vagal tone and can improve your ability to be more resilient. And like taught me, like I can travel across countries and be able to go without food for days if I need to. That's a huge survival advantage that before the pandemic, I was like, I wonder if people realize this about fasting, but it's kind of a survival tool. Like, if you don't have good capacity to fast, like you're kind of screwed if you get food cut off for a few days, you know? So I do think it's an important skill to have, but I really try to break it down in the book as like, here's who should fast, here should not fast. Here's why you should fast, here's why you should not. And I'm trying to bring a discussion to the, because I got a lot of flack for even, I had way more content on fasting in the book that I cut because I got so much feedback from scientists and friends of mine who read the book. And they were like, I don't know about this prolonged fasting stuff. It seems a little, you know, woo. And I'm like, yeah, you say that, but like, I actually think it's really powerful. And, you know, it's funny because like, I do think that there's still a lot of controversy. And I was trying to like be a grounded and centered person around the topic, but I also didn't want to cause, I didn't really want to cause more controversy. Like even Peter Attia has kind of rolled back his perspectives on fasting.
He has. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. He has. No,
people. But I think that probably from his own experience of being insanely stressed out and realizing, oh shit, this doesn't work when I'm stressed, you know?
Much. At this time for me right now, this is too much. Yeah. No, people lose their minds when you talk about fasting. And you have to be really careful about how you explain it too, because the definition of fasting is not eating. But people think of that as it does have to be a 5-day, 7-day, maybe a month long, whatever. Like you can also do, you know, what I would consider like time restricted eating and maybe just not eat as many hours during a single day. And that might be okay for some people.
Yeah. Exactly.
We mentioned exercise just a little bit. I want to go a little deeper there. How have you evolved your thinking around exercise? What do you think is the most beneficial way that we can be moving our bodies?
Well, in the book, I talk a lot about some of the more important facets of exercise being, you know, weight training, flexibility, cardio, HIIT training, and just the importance of non-exercise activity thermogenesis. But, one of the things that I think is really important for people to realize is that like the vast majority of people should just be trying to get some weightlifting in 2 to 3 days a week, maybe four, if you're trying to really build muscle and obviously five, if you're a bodybuilder, but like the cardio discussion has really changed a lot for a lot of people. Like there's this realization that we need a lot less cardio than we thought we did. But we still need to sprint on occasion and really rev up that heart rate. But that chronic cardio and that excessive HIIT training that people have been doing with like Orange Theory and Barry's, like it's starting to become evident that it's maybe not healthy long-term to do that much HIIT. And so I shy away from that stuff because I think it's a little too intense. People are already so stressed as it is. But I'm like, one of the things that I'm particularly interested in learning more about is like animal movement and martial arts. And so I think the key for most people is figuring out what makes them come alive and what do they look forward to doing? What do they really enjoy? What do you like to do? You know, not what you have to do, but what do you look forward to doing?
Yeah, no, I love that. I think the animal moves kind of movement itself is so interesting and just is an accessible and easy way that most people can learn how to use their bodies and the ways that humans are designed. Like we can do so many different things that other animals are not able to do. Like if you look at our Olympics and all the different sports that we can do really well at, you couldn't do the same thing for other species of animals. They can only do like their one or two specific things that they do. But as humans, we need to move in such a variety of different ways. And so incorporating any of that is fantastic. And I noticed the same thing. I worked on a metabolic cart for over a decade, and anybody who overexercised and pushed their heart rate too high too frequently, especially when it was paired with the diet in January, you're going to crash your metabolism. And it's not that easy to get it back. It takes a long time and a lot of work, and you are going to be cold and pissy and probably have autoimmune issues and have all kinds of problems to be able to get back that metabolism that you've crushed.
Yeah. And I think most people need to start with like, let's start with non-exercise activity thermogenesis. Like we're all sitting too much. Like the last, you know, few hours of my day was just, I have a treadmill desk that I'm just going to set up. And it's like, cause I noticed I just need to move more throughout the day. You know, like I'm moving too little. Got to get more exercise in. It's just not good to sit at desks all day long. It negates a lot of the exercise you do.
Yeah. Totally. That's such a great point. We're basically going to skip the entire like middle part of your book, like all the best stuff. So we can get to the end. I want to talk about your conclusion and the importance of human connection. But before we jump to there, I want to say like, is there one or two other things from everything that you've written that you really want to hammer home for people as far as lifestyle things that they can manage? We've talked nutrition and fasting. Yeah. We've talked about exercise. Yeah. What are some other key things? Stress.
So sleep and stress. Okay. So they really go hand in hand. And I put sleep in the stress section of the book on purpose because your sleep is a reflection of your daytime stress. And when you, I sleep really well. And the only time I haven't slept well in the last year has been when my stress levels were overflowing into my evening. And so I'm actively trying to figure out how to hack this for clients of mine, because there's so much emotion that is not felt in a lot of people's lives. And it will come out in, it'll really come out in the evening and in the subconscious. And your sleep is when your subconscious starts to awaken. And then if you're not really dealing with the stuff that's under the surface during the day, it's going to rear its ugly head at night. So I think it's really, really important for people to really do the work to deal with their daytime stress and triangulate where has it come from, and then really take measures to improve it. And the biggest sources of stress that people have, by the way, I just have the cutest little squirrel outside, like on this tree, like chilling and relaxing. And I'm staring at this guy. He's staring at me, and it's the cutest. It's the cutest thing. I can't get over
that's
it.
So like, I'm not editing that out. That's fantastic.
I'm just like, I'm like walking to this, like, he's like lounging in the tree. He's not even like sitting up straight. He's like sleep. His chin's like on the side of this. It's the cutest thing. Anyway,
that's amazing. So, can I just comment on that and say that that's how I know that you have a great lifestyle, when you can appreciate the simple, stupid, simple little things that we all miss. Like the robin that's sitting it's in the tree is just like joyful. It's amazing. And that to me tells me everything I need to know about your lifestyle.
You're eating. He's snuggling the tree. Like he's like literally like laying like on the tree, like it was like a beach chair. It's so cute.
Love it. Anyway.
So long story short, like I did not fully comprehend how stress was affecting my nervous system until I left San Francisco. And I was living in this like really, really challenging part of the mission, because there was like prostitution and drug addiction and arson fires. And it was like really gritty and noise pollution. I lived by a highway, so there was air pollution. And so here I am. And then I lived in a place that had mold. So here I am in San Francisco, not really like thinking I'm trying to do everything right, but I'm feeling like I'm pushing against health. Like I'm like, oh, like something is holding me down that I should be healthier than this. And it was this realization when I left that like, oh my God, there's this thing called the generalized unsafety theory of stress. Hold on. I got to take a picture of this squirrel. It's just too cute. It's just too cute. Like this is an Instagram post.
That's
all right.
Amazing.
So, all right. You'll see this later on my Instagram. Perfect. But so I was doing all this research on stress, right? And I knew this thing called, you know, the Holmes Raw rating score. And I was like, okay, that's one way to think about stress. It's like just big life events are stressful. That's kind of like old science, right? So yeah, of course, big life acute events can be stressful. But often those are the things that make you stronger, because they're not usually chronic. They're usually like an acute stress. Now, then there's the perceived stress scale, which is like, how stressed do you feel? And I noticed that people who perceive higher stress levels are actually more stressed out, because they're getting this added stress from the subjective interpretation of objective events. And it's like multiplying the stress in their lives. But then I was like, whoa, what about all the metabolic stressors, like the poor quality air and the pollution and like the sound pollution and like the fact that that your nervous system is on high alert if you're living in an environment where you don't know your neighbors, where there might be, like when I was in San Francisco, there was regularly forest fires. So there's smoke in the air. I didn't know my neighbors. I didn't feel safe in my neighborhood, and it was really loud all the time. And so, that's really stressful. But then also obesity and low VO2 max, not having good metabolic fitness, being able to escape danger if you need to, that sends a signal to your cells that you're not safe. And then people who live on the street, like homeless people who have to be awake during the day and they're awake during the night and they're asleep during the day, people who have like these disrupted circadian rhythms, it's really stressful on the nervous system. Especially because like, they don't feel safe at all ever, because they don't have a roof over their head. They don't have community connection. And every time the police are trying to break apart these little street communities, they're like breaking apart the one source of safety these people have, which is people. So I really got this different perspective on stress. And that's that your brain in a safe environment, surrounded by safe people with a roof over your head, is going to by it's going to be able to turn off the resting potential of the resting stress signaling that's like there. Unless you're told that you are safe, there is this system of your brain that will be on hypervigilance until then. And then I started studying trauma because I was studying psychedelic medicine. And I was like, what is this whole thing about trauma? Like how does trauma change the nervous system? And what trauma is doing is trauma is like a stressful life event, a traumatic experience that's being recognized by the nervous system as still present memory. And it's not in the long-term memory. So you're constantly surveying the environment thinking that you're not safe. So the real conclusion to all of this is that your brain needs safety signaling to turn off stress signaling. And when you look at like most doctors' training, they all know that stress causes disease, but they don't know how to help you figure out where your stress is coming from, you know? And that's one of the things that I do in the book and that I do with my clients is like help you triangulate, like where does the stress come from? Because the biggest way to deal with stress is to deal with the source. But then I also have some really good protocols that I didn't include in the book that are on my website and some blog posts that are on HPA axis dysfunction and, you know, optimizing your body and your brain during really significantly high stress states. I should have put it in the book, but there's a lot of controversy around cortisol testing and stress hormones. Mm.
Well, you do such a great job explaining all of that in the book. I know you are a very busy person and you have a hard stop. I wanted to make sure we left time to for you to talk about your online programs. You know, maybe we can conclude this. What is the number one takeaway you would want somebody to walk away from after reading your book?
Well, first that, you know, the big thing is this concept of energy capacity, right? And when your energy exceeds your demands, you feel well-being and you feel resourced. And so you really got to think about building energy into the body like you would building a bank account, because you need an emergency fund. You can't just only produce enough energy, just like enough money to meet your basic needs. And when you start looking at that kind of reflection of your physical wellness as a product of your ability to literally gather electrons and store them as charge in the cell, and eliminating all the things that can drain your energy, or at least try to mitigate them as much as you can, and boost the things that build your energy, you can flourish. And it's not easy. It took me 10 years to get to this point of health because I was not healthy in my 20s. But it's a path of self-discovery, the path of getting well. And a lot of people are like, well, is your book good for chronic illness? And I'm like, honestly, I would recommend the book, Chronic Fatigue Syndrome. It's mitochondria, not hypochondria. And this is a book by Amy Myhill, this MD in Europe. If you're really chronically ill, you want to read a book like that. But this is a book for people who are generally healthy, who want to optimize their health. And so I have a course that's based off the course that I taught at Stanford called Your Health Span Journey. And you can find it on my website. And it's basically like, I would say a very affordable, like extraordinarily like detailed curriculum on health optimization. And I've already had some health coaches take it and they're just like, this is so good. So if you're really interested in learning more from me and you want to go deeper into metabolic health, I would recommend the course.
That's fantastic. This conversation has been wonderful. Dr. Molly, where would you like people to go to find you and connect with you and your work and access that course?
Definitely find me on Instagram at drmolly.co. Find my website, www.drmolly.co. And I'm on LinkedIn and Twitter at Molly Maloof, MD.
Perfect. We'll link all of that. If somebody were to look you up on Instagram, they're going to see a picture of a very cute squirrel. It's great.
Yeah, totally. Hey.
That's awesome.
So, squirrel lounging on a tree and about outside my house.
Still just totally chilling.
Yeah, dude, great. He left. He saw me. I took the photo of him. He was like, I didn't consent to that photo.
I'm out of here. Deuces. Well, this has been amazing. I really enjoy your work and I've really enjoyed this conversation. So thank you so much, Molly. I really appreciate it. And thank you for taking time.
Yeah, hit me up when you're in town so we can hang.
Yeah, that sounds great. All right. We'll see you in a few weeks.
Cool.
Thank you.
Bye.
And this has been another episode of Balanced Body Radio. Thank you, as always, so very much for listening to Boundless Body Radio. We really have such a passion for this work and for sharing our message. I've always said this, and I still believe it, that if I were to win the lottery today, that I would still show up for all of my clients and continue this work starting at 6 a.m. next Monday. It's just really a joy to be able to work with people and share our message, and to be able to share this message with people all over the world, be able to interview all kinds of different doctors and researchers, or just everyday people to share their stories and literally inspire hundreds of thousands of listeners to our show. Last year, we decided to start our Patreon page to be able to share premium content for a subscription fee, which included private coaching, early releases of our podcast, which was unedited, and also my special project of making the Boundless Body Radio premium podcast, which is basically the highlights of all of the hundreds of episodes that we have done, all condensed down into a masterclass of a particular topic, including different macronutrients and also ketogenic diets. The subscription model really wasn't exactly a smash success, to say the least, but I did put a lot of blood, sweat, and tears into those episodes, and I'm really just not that comfortable with them sitting around behind a paywall when they could be out helping people. So we have decided to terminate our Patreon page. I will be releasing all of the content that we created for the Boundless Body Radio premium podcast on our normal show, Boundless Body Radio, for free. So be on the lookout for that in the coming months. And be sure to leave any feedback that you might have. If you enjoyed them, we'd really love to hear from you. They were really fun to make, and I really enjoyed reviewing all of our content to create them. But like I said, if they're not out there helping people, I'm just not really okay with that, and I really want them to get out and help. So remember that you can always book a free complimentary 30-minute session with us on our website at myboundlessbody.com. We've really enjoyed connecting with people all over the world to discuss all things health and fitness. And so feel free to do that and take advantage of that. And as always, thank you again so much for listening to Boundless Body Radio.